Good morning and welcome to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. Well, we've got another great spring day here in Greenwich and a beautiful morning. I think it's going to warm up a little bit more and the rain is kind of pushed out. So I think overall we're in pretty good shape. Today's subject, actually today's guest, is actually a longtime Greenwich resident. Fascinating individual, fascinating work, and I thought gracious to join us this morning. Hopefully, Jack, you didn't have to get up too early. I'm here to introduce and welcome Jack Trout to our program. Jack is recognized as one of the world's foremost marketing strategists. He's the originator of positioning and other important concepts in marketing strategy. He has over 40 years of experience in advertising and marketing, and became a boardroom advisor to some of the world's largest corporations, and his worldwide consulting work gives him firsthand experience in a wide range of marketing scenarios. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
So it sounds like you're in heavy demand. What do you think?
Oh, I wouldn't say heavy demand. The question of, you know, the world is a changing place, and a lot of my demand right now is from China and India, of all places, which is where the money is, and so in a way, my demand kind of varies by what's happening in the global economy.
So, and I want to come back to that. It's very interesting. So you mentioned China and you said India?
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Yeah. Now, again, you've published numerous books, co-published books. You speak around the world on this. Tell us a little bit about the business that you're in. What is it exactly that you do?
Yeah, well, actually, I'm in the, I would say, the strategy business, basically, And it's all based on a body of work I published many, many years ago on a subject called positioning. And the point I made is that the ultimate battleground for whatever you're selling, whether it's a car, a soap, or religion, or a politician, it all takes place in the mind. It's all about perceptions and how you build perceptions and how you get into people's minds. And I've developed a whole body of work on that idea. And I think that's kind of what I do. And the reason a place like China is suddenly very interested is because they're moving from being a manufacturing-based economy to more of a market-based economy, where they have to start to build brands and to figure out what they can sell as opposed to what they can make. So it's so that is really what's happened. And of course, as the world becomes more and more of a marketing problem, a lot of what I've written becomes more popular.
So when your phone rings, typically, who's on the other end and what's going on?
Well, it varies. It could be, a small organization, entrepreneurial organization that's looking for help. They're starting something, and they are, as we say, long on ideas and a little short on money. And then we have the large corporations that are sort of foundering or whatever, and they're long on money and short on ideas. So those would be the two types. And, of course, I say, who do I think I'd rather work with? So the guys that are short on ideas and long on money. I've done work, as I like to say, from computers to caskets and just about everything in between.
So back over to China for a moment. When you mentioned China, are you talking about specific organizations, companies in China, or are you speaking of the Chinese government or both?
Well, not the government. It's it would be the companies in China, the entrepreneurs that are in China, and I do. So it's a combination of working with through a partner. I have local partners who I work with around the globe, and so I work with them on local companies, what's happening, et cetera, and I'll do lecturing on the side when I happen to be there, to, generally speaking, the entrepreneurial business class in China. There's, as you know, the Chinese government owns a lot of the large operations in China, but there's a sea of very wealthy entrepreneurs and young business people who are trying to start businesses or have businesses in China, because China has such a vast internal market.
So have you ever or would you ever work with a government?
Oh, yeah, I'm working with the U.S. government. I did some work for the State Department some years ago on how to better America's reputation around the globe. Funny story, I made this big presentation on what they should be doing, and the State Department people said, well, we have a problem. And they said, that's a good idea. And I said, well, what's the problem? Well, we're about to invade Iraq. And I said, well, there goes your image. Yeah, call me when that's over.
Okay. I guess they're going to be calling you soon, yeah?
No, they haven't called me since.
It makes me think, though, also of Afghanistan, and I know there was a big image problem going back just a few years with the U.S. military and how they had to change some of the perceptions. And I'm not well steeped in the particulars there, but what I do know is that they had feet on the ground, developing relationships with the local, let's call them the very influential people, and there seemed to be somewhat of a change. Now, of course, we know that the place is still a mess, but there seemed to be some positive impact. Were you at all close to that, or?
No, not really. The work I did for the State Department sort of, if it's on a shelf there, who knows? It sort of disappears into the labyrinth of people. So I don't know, whatever. So, but no, I haven't been involved. The problem with Afghanistan is if I was looking at it as a company, they have some real structural problems. They have, it's going to be a very difficult marketing problem because of the structural difficulty they have. It's tribal. It's, there no infrastructure. Nobody's educated. So that's a tough problem.
When you, whether it's a corporation or a governmental agency, et cetera, what is your overall approach? How do you begin? Where do you start?
You start with your competition. In other words, as I tell people, it's not what you want to do, it's what your competition will let you do. This is a wildly competitive world we live in right now. So when you start any strategy problem, you got to look at the competition. What's out there? Who's doing what? Because you have to avoid your competitive strength, and you have to figure out a weakness that you can move against. Now, that's okay, and that's the general thing. Normally, if you're just inventing something new, fine. Now you're coming up with something that's dramatically different, and there's probably not too much competition right now, but you will attract it very quickly if you have any success. So step one is competition.
I know you hit that also in another international marketing bestseller, Marketing Warfare. But just yesterday, I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and I've got it here in my hands, the announcement by General Motors, and I'm quoting now from that article, they're looking to cut costs, and they said it will consolidate the global advertising business for its Chevrolet brand with a newly created joint venture of Omnicom Group, Inc., and Interpublic Group. And I thought that was fascinating. I thought, oh my, and I do a lot of work in the advertising industry, consulting and executive coaching, leadership work. And just yesterday I was meeting with one of my clients, and I thought, yeah, that was kind of blew them away. I mean, fierce competitors, and now they've got to play nice. It's hard enough to get the portfolio companies within the same holding company to play nice, but now you've got fierce competitors. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's a. I personally feel that I don't see that ever working. I think you put your finger on it. I mean, one half of the team is going to figure out how do I undercut the other half.
Right.
I mean, come on, that's just the human condition. I mean, I just don't see anything. I don't know. Look, Chevrolet's problem is very, very simple. They have not effectively figured out what their strategy is. And I have written about them, and I've talked about them, and I said, look, Chevrolet's strategy is very simple, and I'll give it to you in exactly what they should say. This is America's favorite American car. That's what they should be saying. That's their platform. That's what their natural position is, and that's what they should build their programs around. In other words, giving people, whatever reason, and then you end up with what title it says, number one ball in golf. Leadership is one of your most powerful ideas, and that's what they should do. And then you find an agency who can bring that to life and dramatize it. You don't need to have two agencies, slicing each other up. I mean, it's crazy. But that's when you lack a strategy, that's what happens.
And again, I'm just quoting right from this article. It says that GM spent $4.47 billion on advertising in 2011 alone. So it sounds like, from what you say, it's a fairly simple message, and they're spending a lot of money to getting the message out there. But are you suggesting it may not be the correct message?
They don't have the message.
They don't have the message.
They don't have the message.
So they're spending $5 billion.
Chevy runs deep? Yeah. What the hell does that mean?
Uh-huh.
I have no idea. See, that's they don't have that. That's what I do. I walk into these companies and say, now, guys, look, here's what you are. Now you have to bring it to life. Now you build a story around that idea. Because good marketing, whatever you're selling, is good storytelling. What's your story? America's favorite American car is an interesting story.
I love it. It reminds me of my dad, now long deceased, but World War II veteran, barber in Weston, Connecticut, and he was a Chevy man.
Well, you can say that. You can use your heritage. We've always been America's favorite American car. And yeah. And that's that. And of course, as more and more people begin to think, well, we got to figure out jobs in America, it reinforces that idea.
I find it amazing, because I've been consulting to organizations for close to 30 years now, and I find it hard to believe that I'm saying that, but it's true. So many bright people, so much money spent and invested in strategic planning, and they've got marketing experts and these CMOs with incredible credentials and backgrounds and things like that, and it sounds like many of these so-called very smart, intelligent companies, I'm speaking very broadly right now, just they're not getting it. What's
Absolutely.
Going on?
Absolutely. Look, I wrote a book called In Search of the Obvious, and essentially I say your most powerful ideas are simple, obvious ideas that everybody looks at. The one I just talked about, America's favorite American car, that's an obvious idea. Now, the problem is, to get there, all you need is common sense. All you need is very simple common sense, and essentially the trouble with a lot of these people, they leave their common sense in the parking lot when they come to work. And they get inside, and they look at all the numbers, and they get buried in too much research and so much stuff, and they get cute. And they don't see the clarity of what they should be looking at. It's so simple, but they don't think that way. You're right. They just get enmeshed in all of the folderol that comes with marketing.
It sounds like this is a classic example of making the simple complex.
Exactly. Yeah, keep it simple, stupid. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
So I want to just touch on, because it sounds, what I like, I would imagine your work is very interesting. I'm sure it's very different depending on the client and the situation. Sometimes it might involve, like you said, a startup. It could be a well-established company where the competitive landscape has changed, or the overall environment, the marketplace has changed.
Right.
And so they've got to kind of rethink some of their positioning. What about a company like JetBlue, who I don't have to remind everybody of the story that's been in the headlines, but then they had Slater.
The pilots have freaked out.
They had a Slater just a year or so ago. Go down the emergency chute with two beers in his hands, things like that. I would imagine, though, seriously, that this is a well-known, respected company. And do people start to think, my gosh, should JetBlue be thinking about how they are being perceived right now? Because you mentioned that up front when I asked you what is it all about, and you talked about position, you talked about perceptions. Are they in potential trouble?
Well,
will this blow by quickly?
Yeah, I would say this, that yes, that kind of event is not going to help their brand, without a doubt. People are going to say, they have a gigantic PR problem, though. And essentially, they have to do something to change that. And I think what you've got to do is they should probably put together some kind of a program, a very careful program. We're going to do a much more in-depth analysis of our people and what they're doing, et cetera, even though it might not exist now in the industry. And I think they're going to have to take some steps, to sort of work around these problems, because you're right. I think they're beginning to build a perception, that the people who work for them are a bunch of nutcakes, and that's not going to work at all.
I mean, every time you step on that plane, and I do a lot of flying, you do a lot of flying, a lot of our listeners do a lot of flying, you're in the back of your mind, you're wondering, is this guy going to snap? And thank God for the co-pilot that he, quick judgment, quick action, and the several people who helped bring this captain down and secure,
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, luckily they had a plane load of relatively large guys who took care of this guy. I don't know. It's a gigantic PR problem. And I'll tell you something, you got to move very aggressively to counter these types of events, really, with specific programs. What are we going to do? And they really have to.
Do you think they're doing that?
Not yet.
No, see, I got the same sense.
Hiding
I really
out.
Did. Yep. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I got the same sense that what are they doing? Where are they? What are they communicating?
Well, think about it. Here's what's happened. CEO has said, I've known this guy for 10 years. He seems like a nice guy. What the hell kind of a stupid statement is that? I mean,
right.
you have, that's not the answer.
I've got to question the CEO's judgment then as well. Now, remember after 9/11, the big debate, and I believe that this is now allowed, where they allow guns in the cockpits.
Yeah.
That thought crossed my mind as I was reading some of the articles. Imagine, and I don't know if there was a gun in the cockpit, but imagine, my gosh, if there was. Now you got to rethink that whole idea of do we put guns in the cockpits? And I know this is a rare, isolated event, but we're seeing people snap all over the place.
That is very true, and I think, you know, that to me is the number one reason that we should get rid of a lot of the guns in the country is because of that very reason, that we're in a kind of a wild and crazy, high-pressure society, and people, we see this. They get crazy and they snap, and if they have a gun in their hand, you know, they kill people. And I think that's, you know, that alone is an anti-NRA position to take and say that, guys, you know, America, you know, can't handle it. I mean, it's getting nutty.
That's right, and I would agree with that. That needs to take a very close look. Needs to be taken at that. You had mentioned also after the introduction, you know, whether it's car, soap, religion, politician, and that certainly has my interest. So, the Catholic Church, and again, I don't need to remind everybody all the going back, especially a couple of years ago. I don't believe that this thing is complete. And by the way, I just want to say that I am a member of the Catholic Church. It is, and I have my views in terms of how they handled these abuse scandals. But before I share my view, I'm wondering, do you have a view on that?
Well, I have always said that the problem with the Catholic Church is its management. And I'm also Catholic, but I look at these people and I say, what are you people thinking about? And I just take the latest bad piece of PR management, the birth control issue.
Mm-hmm.
That the bishops jump on now, and they want to claim religious freedom. Well, no, I don't understand that. Catholics have walked away from the birth control thing decades ago. It's not an issue. And suddenly you're going to try to make it an issue? I mean, to me, I think most people look and say, what are these guys thinking about? You know, what do they think? I mean, who cares? What is this religious freedom stuff and birth control? So, I mean, I think they make a lot of what I consider terrible PR mistakes. Our beloved Egan, remember, he came back and changed his mind about the pedophilia thing. And he interviews Catholic Magazine, one of the magazines up there, and says, I never should have said what I said.
That's right.
I won't admit anything. I mean,
I thought that was nuts. And I knew Bishop Egan. I've been a catechist preparing kids for confirmation for over 20 years in my hometown of Ridgefield, part of the Bridgeport Diocese, when he was bishop. For the Bridgeport Diocese, and it was a head scratcher to me. I'm thinking, and then I also once the files were released to the public, and I got a hold of some of those. I thought, my gosh, so many people knew about this, pushed the problem around, and now he comes out saying that he's sorry that he said the things that he did that should have been said, and it should have been said a lot earlier.
Well, that's what I mean by management problem and gigantic PR mistakes. I mean, that was a silly thing. And, of course, the current bishop, was it Laurie or somebody, you know, quickly walked away, and I want to talk about that. I mean, but, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, one of the chapters in my book on positioning is repositioning the Catholic Church. I did a lot of strategy work for the Catholic Church many, many years ago, coming out of Vatican II, and I said, here's what you guys should do. And of course, you know, totally ignored. But it is a classic example. If you want to talk about bad PR, essentially it's the church, and that's what their problem is right now.
And do you know if they use? Because I don't. Do you know? Do they use outside experts, or do they kind of keep it within the fold? So
they
speak?
Keep it within inside.
They don't.
I tried. I was part of a small group in New York that went down and tried to talk to. Bishop, I guess it was O'Connor, whatever one it was,
mm-hmm.
the cardinal, and I got a real sense of you can't really, unless you, as somebody said, Jackie got the wrong collar on. Unless you're part of the team, and even the team members are very difficult. You just good outside objective thinking is not welcome in the Catholic Church.
I think that's unfortunate too.
It is unfortunate because, again, as I say, all the world is a marketing problem, and that's why really. we're kind of the last generation. I mean, I look around and my children, you know, nobody's, very few, they're losing an enormous amount. And everybody's, a lot of people who are going off to those, you know, the other types of churches that are out there. But I think it's, they've always had this problem, but I think it's today, it's in this highly over-communicated world, it's a big problem for them.
Now, you also mentioned at the right after the introduction the idea of a politician and positioning and messaging.
Yep.
And you know, although this is not a political show, I think that it's great just to, when I think about, for instance, what's going on with the, you know, the Republican candidates.
Yeah.
What would your advice be to Romney, Santorum, Gingrich? I think those are still the three main players. Gingrich,
well,
he's not getting out anytime soon.
Yeah, I would say, gentlemen, you are now in what we call a circular firing squad.
It reminds me of hunters. My uncle was a hunter.
You are now a circular firing. You're now shooting at each other.
Okay.
That's not going to work. To me, one guy should say he's going to run, and that's it, and the rest of you people should get out, because you are doing yourself enormous damage, and because you are a shooting at yourselves. Number two, to appeal to the base, you're saying some outrageous things, which, believe me, will come back to haunt you in the general election, because they're all being very carefully taped. And so, in other words, if you want my opinion, because of this circular firing squad and because of what's going on in this thing and because of all the super PAC stuff, my sense is that the Republicans have done themselves enormous damage in the presidential side of the ledger. And I don't think they'll survive.
I would actually agree with that. And now, if you were advising President Obama and his team, it seems like they're just kind of they're letting the Republicans do their own damage.
Yep.
And just kind of, is it a good strategy, or is that a conscious strategy? And if so, a good strategy?
Oh, no, it's a wonderful strategy. Yeah. You're kidding. They're sitting there, so let's see what they do to themselves today.
Right.
I mean, it's wonderful. I mean,
as they implode.
You know, they're just waiting for the general election.
Yeah.
And they're collecting all the stuff that these people are saying, and it'll show up again at some point in time. No, I think what I've been saying, and I've been down in Washington with some folks down there, and I've been saying, look, ladies and gentlemen, the key is we got some big problems that need solving, and that should be the thrust of if I was a Democrat, I'd say you should be pushing the problem solving thing, and because that's really what we got to deal with. And I think, and the other side of the coin is, if I were Obama, I would come back and reclaim what made him once famous—the red state, blue state.
Yeah.
I would sort of say, guys, we got these problems, and if we don't get it together, united we win, divided we lose, and we're going to have to. And I would talk about he's up against Congress and wants to do nothing. So in a way, he should seize the high ground, which I think will appeal to a lot of independents and a lot of moderates.
We're going. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, please, Jack.
Go ahead. I'm finished.
No, we're going to take a very short break. When we come back, I'd like your thoughts. You could pick any one or combination of these things. We'll have a few minutes after the break. Your most interesting assignment or most challenging? Did you ever turn down an assignment? Or if you could pick up like a dream assignment, what would that be? So when we come back, maybe your thoughts on that. We are speaking with Jack Trout, legendary marketing strategist, best-selling author, and you are listening to 1490 WGCH, the Business of Living Show. We'll be right back.
It may not require a textbook, but it's filled with valuable lessons. It may not take place in a classroom, but it's an ideal environment for learning. It may not involve a diploma, but it can help prepare Connecticut's young people for life. It's high school sports. High school sports can play a critical role in a student's overall education. In fact, studies show that students that participate in high school sports are more likely to enjoy greater levels of achievement in their academic lives. If you think high school sports are only about competition, think again. Better yet, think about attending a high school sporting event in your community. You'll be amazed by what you see. High school sports, a winning part of a complete education. This message presented by the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference and the Connecticut Association of Athletic Directors.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella, speaking with Jack Trout, legendary marketing strategist, best-selling author. And Jack, in the final moments that we have, would love your thoughts on most interesting assignment, most challenging. Have you ever turned down an assignment? Or if there was an assignment you could pick up right now, a dream assignment, what would that be?
Well,
so pick any combination of those.
Well, I have to say that the work I did for the State Department on America's Image was probably the most interesting thing that I did. I think that was kind of fun. Though Washington is not a fun place to have to go. It's just a very difficult operation. But so I would say that the country thing is when I get into country work, they're very interesting. I did a lot of work in Spain on how they should increase their tourism business. That's the most interesting stuff you can get into. But it's also probably the most frustrating because it's so politically oriented that it's
right.
hard to get anything sold. That's the problem.
How do you measure results? Or how do your clients measure?
It depends on what you see. You know, obviously perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Perceptions and, of course, eventually sales success. But you measure, you're trying to say, all right, what's in people's minds? And essentially, how do I change perceptions? And you measure those perceptions, which is easy to do.
Now, I know you deal with corporations, organizations, et cetera. There's a trend that's been going on, this whole idea of personal and professional branding. You know, it gets down to the individual. Do these principles or can these same principles apply if somebody's trying to either do a makeover or create a specific identity for themselves as an individual, let's say going for a job, just presenting themselves in a different way?
I would say that it is to some degree. I mean, I wrote a book called Horse Sense with my ex-partner, and that was on personal positioning. And the essence of it was called, you know, find a horse to ride, find an idea, a person, a family. In other words, no, don't go to one. Don't think it's all about the Tony Robbins, you could be great type stuff. No. Success is outside of you. What can you do? How can you attach yourself to something and build your, if you want to say, personal brand around that idea or that connection? So, no, I think it's doable. What offsets it is all this stuff about you can do whatever you want to do, you can be dare to be great, all the self-help crowd, which I find the only people who make money on self-help stuff are the self-help people.
So would you recommend if an individual is looking to, let's say, brand themselves and go down this road, is this something they can do themselves or do they need...
Well, look, I get asked this by young people. I say, look, A, you know, figure out what you're good at. B, find some smart people to work for and work with. Try to avoid stupid people. Because it's life is a learning process. And so I do think that. But the trick is, it's like products. You know, stay focused. What are you? What's your position? And don't muck it up. The trouble with people, they fall in the same everything for everybody trap. I can do anything. You can't do everything. You got to find out really what you're good at.
That is, Jack, thank you so much. We're out of time. Unfortunately, that is great advice. I hope people will heed that. We have been speaking with Jack Trout, legendary marketing strategist, best-selling author, and you've been listening to The Business of Living. Remember, you only have one life. Why not live it on purpose? Thanks for joining us. So long.